You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is another Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson. It is the 28th of December, 2025. And we're going to close out the year with something that's going to ruffle a few feathers. I've heard it said for a long time that the Book of Esther has no place in any Christian Bible, regardless. And that's a false statement. It's certainly in the Orthodox one. It's in the Catholic one. Martin Luther, of course, you know, ripped it out, given his great authority to do so. The Church Fathers generally supported it. But the key thing to remember, especially for people who consider themselves, you know, nationalists, just because Jews have taken something and created, you know, ran with it, made it part of their identity, doesn't mean it's false. Yes, they've distorted it beyond belief. It has nothing to do with them. If anything, Haman, the oppressor in this story, or the Jewish commissars of the USSR, among other places. You guys know I haven't been all that well over the last few months. This is a guy who never gets sick and now is sick all the time. Blood pressure, the colitis is all done with, heart enlargement. I had the stress test done, all that crap that I thought that only old men got. I'm only 54. But I'm making great strides. And, I don't know if that fits into this book or not, but, any help you can give me, of course, as always, I would appreciate. So the title of this paper is The Misunderstood Book of Esther, a patristic analysis of the righteousness of Esther and Mordecai. Book of Esther, this is set in the first Persian Empire, the Achaemenid Empire under Xerxes, who ruled until, you know, from 486 to 465 BC. Now, The book doesn't give many specific dates, you know, in our years that we would understand. But that's the time frame here. And there's so much background here. It's one of the reasons, you know, that just picking up the Bible, just any layman picking up the Bible is almost an absurdity. To a great extent, my vision of Xerxes is from the movie, a great movie, a wonderful movie. From a historian's point of view, a beautiful movie. But there has to be background understood as far as this Persian Empire. When I say Persian Empire, it was the largest empire in the world at the time. But they had this concept of we call it a banquet, but that word doesn't do it justice. There's 10 of them throughout the book. It's a short book. But in almost every secondary source I've read, they refer to the Jews. It was no such conception at the time. These were, whether they were Israelites, the worshippers of Yahweh, these were not enemies of God at the time. We are descended, at least theologically, from the Israelites. This is about us. The Ashkenazi Jews who pretend otherwise, who get wasted every year, thinking that this is not about them, they have nothing to do with it. They are the oppressors. The book displays a rather extraordinary knowledge of the functioning of the Persian court and many details of historical interest, which, to be honest, you know, it is a book of it has to be taken seriously. It is not a work of fiction. But let's start off with the concept of a banquet, for lack of a better term. It was a central part of the Achaemenid royal ideology, the Persian royal ideology. It was a means of demonstrating power. It brought everyone together, everyone who mattered together, even people who didn't matter together. They were done locally, and they were done at the federal level where the emperor was. Now, the secondary sources, even the book itself, refers to him as a king. Xerxes as a king, he's an emperor. A king doesn't quite do it justice. Those are minor issues. Access to the emperor was normally very strictly controlled, but not during the banquets. So anyone who could get to the emperor's ear, including people who otherwise would have no access, could be heard. I was always reminded with this book, the great conqueror Alexander, his 80-couple mass wedding in 324 BC to unify the empire, though that was less successful. It was called the Susa Weddings. It was a deliberate attempt to mix the races, to mix Greek and Asiatic. A Greek had to marry an Asiatic in order to be granted a dowry by him. And he thought that by this kind of display, banquet in and of itself, that he would then, racially mix the entire area to create one nation state. Many of my opponents probably don't know that Alexander was obsessed with the concept. But as far as the Jews are concerned, we're talking about Israelites here, not Jews. The Orthodox are the descendants of the Israelites. This is prior to the resurrection of Christ, the establishment of the true church. The Israelites here were not the enemies of God at this point. They were far from it. This is not a book about the Jews. The fact that later pagan Khazars took this book and pretended that it was about them has no bearing on anything, should have no bearing on how we approach it. They and their allies are Haman. We'll get to who that is here in a bit. At the time this was written, there were no rabbis, there was no Kabbalah, there was no Talmud. And if you read mainstream writings on the topic, of course, which there are thousands, they write as if we're dealing with today's Jews, like my dentist down the street, hiding from the Nazis and always beguiled them for absolutely no reason. So I don't want to assume you know the plot. So I'll lay it out as briefly as I can. Xerxes is holding a very lengthy 180-day banquet for his court and dignitaries. And from across this was a huge empire, 127 provinces. And after that, for about 2 weeks, another one just for inhabitants of the capital city, which was Susa at the time. They didn't have a capital in the sense we had a capital, but it was the administrative center. Xerxes had a queen, Vashti, and she was ordered to, quote, display her beauty before the guests. And that could mean a lot of things. It probably was some sort of a dance of some sort. It reminds me of John the Baptist. But she refused. And that infuriated a man like him. And she was removed from her position as empress. And in fact, there was a whole movement saying that you can't have women acting like this. They're told to do something, do it. What good is their beauty if not for display? It literally is for display. That's how little babies are born. So then arrangements are made to choose a new queen. A selection of beautiful young women throughout the empire. There is a Israelite orphan named Esther, raised by her cousin, uncle, something named Mordecai. She very much entrances the emperor and is crowned quickly thereafter. Doesn't say that she is worships Yahweh only and all that stuff, but it's worth saying that Mordecai, who was at the temple gates, the palace gates, these huge complexes, so many rooms, the gates were the entryway. But it was there where he discovered a plot by two mid to high level courtiers, Bigthan and Teres, to assassinate Xerxes. And because of his identification, they were apprehended, and they were hanged. But after that, the emperor appoints Haman as his viceroy, as something like a prime minister. Now, the way that they bowed, it got to the point, Haman, once he received the viceroy position, it went to his head in the worst possible way. And going to a follower of Yahweh, as we would have been at the time, the sort of bowing that he wanted from him, he couldn't do. This should sound familiar to you. We're getting to the three little kids in the furnace now. The golden image of Dora. But Haman discovers soon that Mordecai refuses to bow, not because he's a jerk, but because he worships Yahweh only, and he's not and only that kind of position, that kind of kowtowing is only for God. So Haman wants to start murdering all the Israelites of the empire. And in fact, even Xerxes gives him permission against the payment of 10,000 talents of silver. The date on which this is done was done through lot, and the word for lot is pur. Pur is singular, putim is plural. Hence, that's where that term comes from. Now, the 13th of the month of Adar. So a royal decree was issued throughout the empire to destroy all who worship Yahweh. And we see in the book of Daniel, this happens on a pretty regular basis. So, Mordecai discovers this. He implores Esther to intercede with the emperor. But she's worried about doing so. You can't just wander into, everything is ritualistic. And that goes to all royal governments. Everything is a ritual. You can't just wander through the hallways. You can't just wander into the emperor's chambers. And she's frightened. But she says, Mordecai, have all the Israelites fast for 3 days. On the third day, she goes to Xerxes, who stretches out his scepter, golden scepter, to indicate that she should not be punished by going into his room, despite her being the empress. That night, the emperor couldn't sleep. Again, very similar to Daniel. Or maybe the king of Daniel slept too much. And there's a connection, of course, between Empress Vashti and the book of Daniel. So what he did, I guess to fall asleep, was to order court records to be read to him. And within these records, it was Mordecai who caught those two guys that were going to assassinate him. But he received zero recognition. And Haman was extremely upset that Mordecai was being now venerated even higher than himself. Once the fast was over, Esther had her own banquet to which she invited Haman, Xerxes, of course. And she was so beguiled, you know, she was so beautiful, she was so, not just beautiful, but very intelligent and engaging, that the emperor promised to grant her any request. And she reveals that she worships Yahweh alone, and that Haman is planning to exterminate all her people, including her. Remember, Haman is there, overcome by rage, which Xerxes was very much capable of. He left the room. He'd get some air. Haman runs up to Esther on the couch and begs for his life. Somehow, the emperor comes back that very moment. It looks like Haman is assaulting the empress. He probably wasn't. He probably wasn't. But from his point of view, it looked like he was. That made him angrier. And then orders that Haman be hanged on the very gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. And in fact, even more than that, since a formal royal decree cannot be annulled, things are added, but it can be things to be added to it. Anyone involved, anyone agreeing to this, was also to be hanged, not just Haman. All told, maybe 75,000 people. That's probably an exaggeration. This is a symbolic number, but they're killed by the Israelites, who were then careful to take no plunder. They were ordered to take no plunder here. That's the basic story. I came across this in a work by a Monophysite author, an abbot, Tadros Malati, a contemporary Coptic theologian based in Alexandria, Egypt. In his work, 2021 work, The Book of Esther, I draw from him very heavily. It's very good. The translation's weak, but I can't speak Arabic, so. Esther's original name was the name of the myrtle tree, Hadassah, or Myrtle. Apparently, she was the daughter of Abigail from the tribe of Benjamin, born in captivity, and then brought by Mordecai into the capital city of Susa. St. Augustine spent a lot of time talking about this book, and he believed that Ezra was its author. But other church fathers, like St. Clement of Alexandria, thought it was, and Josephus, too, thought it was Mordecai himself. And it's clearly written right after the era of the emperor, Artaxerxes I, the third son of Xerxes. And it's based on the fact that it refers to the emperor in the past tense, but it provides tremendous and very accurate details of the royal palace. That palace was destroyed by fire 40 years after the emperor was assassinated. That emperor was assassinated in 425. So the person who wrote this book had tremendous authority. It indicates that the author was an Israelite who lived within the Persian Empire, had seen the palace and had been there constantly and witnessed these events, was well acquainted with the names of the emperor's people, all kinds of Persian words and expressions. But there are many who claim that this should not be in the scriptures, the Old Testament, or the Bible at all. People have raised doubts about its authenticity, although people have to define what authenticity is. Does authenticity mean, does it clash with doctrine? Did these things not happen? Did some of these things happen? How many aspects of this have to happen before it becomes authentic? And wouldn't they know better than we would? The big claim, and I know most of you have probably heard this before, in the Hebrew version, there are two versions of this. The Hebrew version, God is not mentioned. A lot of people who make that claim don't realize that there's two versions of this. The Greek version, of course, has God and prayer all over the place. When I remember when I first came across that argument, I started laughing. And you know how many debate when I was a younger man and I cared, these debates over, you know, jurisdiction and, you know, these issues with people online, that we could debate for hours and never mention Christ. And that struck me at the time. That shouldn't strike anyone as odd here. In the bulk of the story, God is not mentioned as such. Yahweh is not mentioned as such. But I don't know how you can avoid it. God's care for his people. Now, there is a sense that the absence of God's name is there because he had forsaken some of them, because they had refused to return to Jerusalem. This is a period of time when Ezra, one of my favorite Old Testament figures, had returned with Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel is included in Jesus' genealogy in the New Testament and laid the ground for the Second Temple. Who were too worried about the trip and the money. Or maybe that it was simply taken from documents from the Persian royal court, and Yahweh, of course, is not going to be mentioned there much at all. Well, the Greek version, God's mentioned all the time, but that in and of itself means absolutely nothing. The other claim is that Xerxes, or any emperor from this empire, had to choose a wife from a very specific group of aristocratic families. But as far as you know, well, many years ago, it was thought that there was only one empress, Amestris. Herodotus mentions her in 479, in the seventh year of his reign. Of course, you know, silence is never an argument. Now, Vashti, as I mentioned, is connected to the book of Daniel because she is a great granddaughter of the emperor Nebuchadnezzar II of Babylon, who was dethroned as this new Persian huge empire was being created. We don't know how the situation was for the last, 8 years of Xerxes' reign. Esther could very well have died, and Vashti may very well have resumed her reign. Vashti not necessarily the name of an empress, but rather a title, which women were called on account of their extraordinary beauty and the favor that the emperor had for them. She was the same Amestris that preceded Esther, probably resumed her reign later on. Remember, Xerxes and his son were known for their passionate outbursts and their weakness for women. To think that they were somehow obligated to only take wives from the seven main noble families, which is an arbitrary number since there was at least 127 provinces. There were many empresses. You think of Peter the Great in this regard. Many opponents of the book say that there's no way that the monarch could not have known Esther's background. Or how could the, you know, I came across an argument that Haman, he issued the decree of annihilation to take effect only after 11 months and was going to pay a huge sum, 11,000 silver talents, into the hands of those who would carry the plan out. Frankly, Xerxes is more interested in her beauty than her race. She was born in captivity. She spoke the Persian language fluently. You can't act like this is, you know, Nicholas and Alexandria. You know, this is a very different social system. They rarely saw each other. This was how the system ran. Because of this huge empire, and transportation was very primitive, enforcement was an issue. People say, how could Haman possibly have wanted to execute it all over the country, all over the empire at the same day? Which, by the way, was determined by consulting magicians and diviners. These men who were also very powerful at court. They claim that this huge sum constituted most of the income of the Persian Empire in 1 year, which, by the way, I challenge. Not at that size. But even if it were true, it didn't matter to Haman because he would confiscate the possessions of the Israelites and then we could make up for it very easily. In fact, even make up make up for his losses against the Greeks, some of those losses we know from the movies. The authenticity of the book is rather extraordinary. Anyone who's going to make up a story is not going to hem himself in by referencing dates according to the Persian calendar and mentioning individuals and their positions at a certain point in time. Descriptions of Persian customs and local customs, customs of the palace that very few people knew within Susa, the citadel, as it would call it. You'd see that in the first chapter, third chapter, 4, 6, 5, 4, 8, 8, among many other places. The author also knew Xerxes' temper very, very well. So the third year of his reign, he creates a banquet to create a consensus to go to war against the Greeks. The banquets were for that. He had to get everyone together. And over a long period of time, it takes a long time to get to the capital. So there was a huge and probably representative sample of the empire there. Should I do this or shouldn't I? He then returned defeated in the seventh year of his reign, according to Herodotus. And at that point is where he held the banquet of Esther. So the concept of Purim has it that has to do with us. That has no connection to the Jews at all. The word means simply a lot, meaning that you're rolling the dice. It was practiced at the time of Josephus. It was known by the Maccabees. Purim was called the Feast of Mordecai. It was perverted, of course, later by the rabbi. Given the situation in Iran and nearby areas, research has been difficult, but wasn't that long ago where Persian inscriptions, Mordecai, or a translation of Mordecai, was clearly mentioned as one of the court officers during the reign of Xerxes. That pretty much confirms the entire thing. Two Persian or Kavala writings to clay tablets from Babylon all mention an individual whose name is understood to be Mordecai in translation. In transliteration, I probably should say. The events of this book take place during the period of the first return of the Israelites from captivity under the leadership of Zerubbabel and the second return under the leadership of the great Ezra. Israelites were God's people. So let the Khazars say whatever they want. But the point is, God proclaims his care even for those who refuse to return to Jerusalem. Because clearly Mordecai was one of the refusers. Now, as far as the name of God or prayer or anything else, people who make that argument against the book don't know what they're talking about. That only refers to the Hebraic version. The Greek version has prayer and God everywhere. It's mostly prayers. In fact, the Greek version has annexes or appendices, prayers, messages, dreams, that kind of thing. Saint Jerome included it in his Latin translation. So, the empires of Media and Persia defeated Babylon roughly 7th century BC, and that created this massive empire we're talking about here. The dominion from India, pretty much from India, the Indian border, to Ethiopia, including parts of Egypt. The author talks about very critical details of the banquet that have been verified. Even just the fact that he says it was in Susa, the capital of Elam, which also, by the way, was the seat of the emperor Chedorlaomer, an obscure figure mentioned in Genesis 14:1, who was killed by Abraham's forces, and that evoked the appearance of Melchizedek, or one of the first appearances of Christ in the Old Testament. Then it was taken over by the emperors of Persia and Media, who made it their winter capital. As far as Vashti is concerned, she was loved only for her beauty and her family position. The one thing he didn't do to Xerxes is say no. That was one of the responsibilities of an empress. She didn't have many. She had to be physically attractive. She was adorned beyond belief. And when she says, no, I don't feel like dancing right now, well, you have nothing else to do. She was dethroned quickly and replaced by Esther. But his anger also, typical of people like that, his anger subsided. And he had every intention of forgiving her. But then his counselors, all these magicians surrounding him, didn't want a newly re-enthroned empress to seek revenge against them. So they came up with the idea, well, let's have this huge a flea market of beautiful women. Here's what St. Jerome has to say about it, and it's interesting in his analysis of part of the book. The philosophers of the world used to take away old covetousness through instigating a new one, take out an old nail through inserting a new one. According to that principle, the seven officers of the royal court acted with Emperor Xerxes. They attempted to take away his longing for Queen Vashti through stirring up his lust for a new virgin, namely, treating one ailment by another one, one sin by another one. It is befitting of us, on the other hand, to overcome our faults through loving virtues, to oppose them, according to the words of the psalmist, depart from evil and do good, seek peace and pursue it. In other words, the officials made use, you know, when someone is that passionately driven, it creates weakness. There's many ways that he can be manipulated. His love for women was his weakness. So he could kind of forget about Vashti by bringing him, you know, this large group of beautiful virgins from all over the territory and choose the one who pleases him the most. Esther, born in captivity, so to speak. She was denied the promised land and the temple with all of its rights and everything else. Maintained both her ethnic and religious spirit in a corrupt pagan world. It's interesting that she also had no father or mother. One of the features of the church, and God's call to Abraham, you see it in all throughout the prophets too. Melchizedek also had no father or mother. Melchizedek, I firmly believe, is Christ in the Old Testament. She had a tremendous spirit of humility, obedience, and submission. But Xerxes was even weaker when he came back from his defeated campaign against the Greeks. He was defeated. The army was defeated. And so it was very easy to manipulate him with these women. Preparations took a very long time. Then after Esther was chosen among them all, once Esther was chosen, he proclaimed, you know, this huge, lengthy banquet, a holiday in the provinces, gave gifts according to the generosity, removed taxes, eliminated debt. In other words, in his joy with Esther, he forgot all the troubles, the great losses he had in his battle against the Greeks. For 1 year, they had full tax relief. Debts were canceled. Remember, Haman, who was a son of Hammedatha the Agagite, he had the same features of Lucifer, turned into a murderer who would never be satisfied except through shedding blood. He was second in position, and he wasn't satisfied there. That name comes from one of the prominent gods of Elam, taken over by the empires, as I said, of Media and Persia, became one of his provinces. He also is a direct descendant of Amalek, 1 Samuel 15. We know this, at least in part, it's possible, because Saul, who disregarded the command of Samuel, did not kill everybody. And some people were permitted to live. So Haman is just the stubborn sin the bit of evil that remains in the world no matter what happens. The emperor put Haman above all the other princes and local rulers. And everyone paid homage to him in a way that he had never experienced before. And again, he was so taken by this when Mordecai refused to do it, he was very upset. Thinking that he was doing it out of jealousy or anger, or that this is typical of the Israelites. Again, think of the gold image, the Plain of Dura in the Book of Daniel. Now, I don't want to give the impression that Israelites didn't bow and even prostrate themselves to the ground before kings. You see this in 2 Samuel 14, 1 Kings 1, verse 16, but not quite in the same way and not within the same context. But when he was asked why he did not bow to Haman in that very harsh way, he told him that he was of Israel. In other words, Haman thought that you had a subversive group in their midst. Saint Adaphat, who was a 4th century Orthodox Church father, who actually was living in the Persian Empire, a few centuries later, 4th century AD, said the following. Like Mordecai, who was persecuted by the wicked Haman, so the Lord Christ was persecuted by wicked people. We all know by whom. And like Mordecai, who prayed for the sake of saving his people from Haman, so by his blood the Lord Christ interceded for his people to save them from the devil. And like Mordecai, who laid in sackcloth and ashes and saved his people, so the word of God came down, bore our body as sackcloth in humility and saved us. And like, by Mordecai, Esther found favor with the emperor instead of Vashti, so Jesus Christ, the church of the new covenant, found favor with God, replacing the synagogue with the church of the New Testament. Christ instigates his church to fast with her whole congregation. Ultimately, like Mordecai, who got the glory and honor of Haman, and before him it was proclaimed, thus shall it be done to the man the emperor delights and honors. And it wasn't Haman. Whereas Christ was glorified by the glory that was his from eternity, and from the Roman guards testifying, saying, truly, this was the Son of God. So far, we have many church fathers who see this as a very orthodox book, although one that is going to play a minor role in liturgy. St. Jerome, St. Clement, Tertullian, Origen. So to say that this wasn't really a part of the early canon is simply not true. It was. It depends on what version you're talking about, though. See, according to St. Jerome, once Haman realized that the refusal to bow down didn't come from insolence or animosity, that made it even worse. And Malachi then prayed, you know all things, you know, O Lord, that it was not an insolence or pride, or for any love of glory that I did this, and refused to bow down to the proud Haman. For I would have been willing to kiss the soles of his feet to save Israel, but I did this so I might not set human glory above glory of God. And I will not bow down to anyone but you, and you are my Lord. That's in chapter 13. In other words, Mordecai would worship no one but God. That's from chapter 13. Haman, typical of the Jews, stirred up everything he could against the church, the Israelites, whispered into his ear, they're lawbreakers, they're not paying taxes. And he got to him. Xerxes said, the money and the men are given to you. Do with them as seem good to you. In other words, here is your force to destroy them. Letters were sent by couriers into all the emperor's provinces to destroy, kill, annihilate all the Israelites, young and old, children, women, one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, Adar, and plunder their possessions. Inclining his ear only to Haman, the emperor did not attempt to investigate or inquire about any other aspects of this, but simply trusted his vizier. And actually, even after this discussion, had him drink again. So, you know, he'd forget about it and they could move on to other things. This is such a Christian book, and it lays out the methods of the Khazar Jews in great detail. In the Greek version, as a copy of the royal decree in it. And here are the main points. It accused the Israelites of betraying the trust of the emperor, breaking laws. Peace can only be restored when they're destroyed. Haman, the second person after the emperor, honored him as a father figure. Must be, we're all committed then to the destruction, to that adversary people, as he calls it, together with their women and children. Very much as the Jews did to Pilate. As the Jews did, this happens all the time. The fall of the Byzantine Empire, the fall of the Spanish, it's found everywhere. Jews whisper into the ears of the non-Christian rulers and say this same kind of thing. But since Esther didn't want to intercede right away, Mordecai didn't put on sackcloth. And a fast was decreed. Esther was willing to risk her life for the sake of the Old Testament church. But she also knew that Xerxes had a temper that sometimes didn't make any sense. She never blamed Mordecai for not paying homage to Haman. She said he was right to do so, saying that it was the sins of my people who caused all this. Not that one act. Of course, there's a lot more to the story of, you know, than merely just bowing. There was a deep theological divide here as well. She didn't seek a temporal solution. She didn't try to seduce the emperor. She resorted instead to prayer and fasting, and asked Mordecai to join her and her maid and her entire entourage, which was, remember, at this, you know, an empire like this is massive. About this, St. Ambrose says, By her fasting, Esther moved the proud heart of the emperor. St. Clement the Roman says, having been perfect in faith, Esther faced danger, not less than faith by Judith, to save the 12 tribes from sure perdition. By fasting in humility, she begged the eternal God who sees all. In the book of the canons, the apostles, by fasting, Esther, Mordecai, Judith were delivered from the evil plot of Haman. This is part of the ancient patristic tradition of the Orthodox Church. This goes back, this is a huge part of the ancient church. I take that back. Not a huge part. A significant part of the ancient church. Just the men I've just listed here. It's the same as the three young men in the furnace. They said, God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fire, and he'll deliver us from your hand. But if not, let it be known to you that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up in Daniel 3. St. John Chrysostom says that Esther saved the entire Israelite and hence future Christian people from utter perdition here. She begged for eloquent speech. Not going to rely on her looks. St. Augustine says that Esther then became a role model for those who occupy high positions in public service. That prayer comes first. He says, Esther, although she was the empress, wife of the emperor, did not keep her from risking her own life to intercede for the sake of her people. When she prayed to God, she said that her crown, her jewels, her money, no more than a filthy rag. So having fasted with most of the Israelite community who did not return to Jerusalem at this time, at least all the Israelites in Susa, Esther approached the emperor, setting up a banquet with him and Haman, which had to have been terrifying. The third day, Esther put on her royal robes, stood in the inner court of the emperor's palace, across from the emperor's lodgings. Again, you can't just barge in there. Still go for sackcloth, of course. So you invoke the aid of God Almighty. She set forth only with two maidservants. One who was right next to her, the other one carried her train. She was terrified. She knew she wasn't allowed to just show up at the emperor on the throne, or anywhere for that matter. That some of that, those laws came from fear of assassination and things like that. She shows up. The emperor Xerxes is in his full array. He looks at her with fierce anger. Now, Herodotus says that the emperors of Media used to forbid anyone to enter the room of the royal throne unless indirectly invited. And that custom was carried on. Despite the initial anger, her appearance softened him. And that's when they embraced and comforted her. What do you want? What are you doing? I'll do whatever you want, even half my kingdom. No one expected to hear that. And all she wanted was this very small banquet where Haman and the emperor can come together. Oh, and when later that night, of course, he remembered or was told about Mordecai's great feat of revealing the possible assassins. So for all those who say that there's no mention of God here, this is Mordecai's prayer at the same time this is going on. O Lord, Emperor who rules over all things, universe is in thy power, and there is no one who can oppose thee. If it is thy will to save Israel, thou hast made heaven and earth and every wonderful thing under heaven. Thou art the Lord of all, and there is no one who can resist thee. Thou art the Lord, Lord God, King, God of Abraham, spare thy people. The eyes of our foes are upon us to annihilate us. The desire to destroy the inheritance that has been thine from the beginning. Hear my prayer, O Lord God, my inheritance. Turn our mourning into feasting, that we may live and sing praise to thy name. Do not destroy the mouth of those who praise thee. Haman, on the other hand, goes to this banquet thinking that this is going to be wonderful. Everything dovetailed perfectly together. The story, I've already mentioned the story as to why he ended up being hanged himself. But he was not happy as this number two. He was a Luciferian in that sense. Mordecai had humiliated himself before God. Haman did the opposite. And nothing changed afterwards. Haman thought he was going to go to this banquet and be, you know, venerated because he was made vizier. That's all he thought about. And yet the truth was, that the night before, because he, you know, couldn't sleep, remembered that it was Mordecai who saved him from the assassins. So it was Mordecai that was venerated rather than, and that was too much for a guy like him. He was so brittle. Obviously, he was a very brittle personality, very fragile, that he lost it. So you have two totally different mentalities. City of God, city of man. Haman, rather than the enemy of the Jews, he is the Jews. The Jews just don't know that. You have so-called theologians and academics who have no conception, who think this is the same group of people. The Jews are the same here as my dentist up the street, my accountant, the guy I went to college with. But it isn't true. They have nothing in common. Don't let their Haman, they are Haman. Jewish oppressors are Haman. As I mentioned, it's not entirely clear, but it was somewhat of a setup, I guess, knowing his personality, Haman's personality, that the minute Xerxes goes out for some air, he probably could tell that Haman was just, you know, barely able to handle, you know, gonna just scream at any moment. He was out for a very short time. When he came back, it appeared that he was accosting her. In other words, the emperor must have started to distrust him for some time. It's very difficult to get across some of these things. When you're dealing with a completely different, you know, social system, men and women did not interact. they had something of a harem, but that was totally non-sexual. I mean, that's where the empress lived. It was a civilization in and of itself. This is the largest empire in the world. But Xerxes, when he saw Haman on the couch with Esther, he must have distrusted him for some time before this. And he says, would he even molest the queen in my presence in my own house? Haman is the Khazar Jews. This is a judgment of Haman for his pride. And Xerxes, it took a little while, but Xerxes finally realized that. The Israelites are our forebears. As it said in chapter 16 of the book of Esther, the Israelites are the children of the living God, the Most High, Most Mighty, who hath directed the kingdom for both for us and for our ancestors in the most excellent order. 16:16. So even a pagan emperor could be led to do the right thing. Mordecai then was raised even higher. No one missed Haman once he was eliminated. All the provinces of the kingdom received two royal decrees. The first was sent by Haman from Shusha, you know, get the killing annihilation of the Israelites. And the second, sent by Mordecai from the same place, authorizing the Israelites to hold the sword, defend themselves against their enemies. You know, the custom was you couldn't take back a royal decree. In other words, they saw them coming. And once they realized what had happened in the capital, the book, well, I could just read it directly. The Israelites gathered together in their cities throughout all the provinces of the empire to lay hands on those who sought them their harm, and none could withstand them. All the officials, the provinces, satraps, governors, and those doing the emperor's work helped the Israelites because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. To think that this doesn't belong in the Old Testament or the Bible is absurd. You're not talking about Jews here. The word Jew is completely inappropriate. You talk about Jew, we mean, you know, the rabbinic Ashkenazi Talmudist or Kabbalist. That didn't exist here. Let these lunatics believe that this book is about them. That they're the ones, that Esther is really theirs. No, Esther is ours. As years have gone by, centuries have gone by, the rabbis have developed all kinds of esoteric views upon this. Which just, you know, added to the nonsense. And this is what's fed the current, you know, just look up the, you know, literature. It's popular literature on the book of the book of Esther. And they'll talk about, you know, the poor Jews being assaulted by the proto-Nazis for no reason. Haman was just another Hitler, you know. And of course, they couldn't do it because the Jews are the immortal people. Well, that simply isn't true. We're talking about people who coalesced around the Khazar Empire in the early Middle Ages. The Orthodox Church, especially the ancient Orthodox Church, East and West, they are the guardians of the Old Testament. They're the manifestations of what it is to be an Israelite. It's a war against heresy. It's a war against division. Esther most certainly belongs in the Old Testament. I don't care what the Orthodox Jews say about anything. The concept of a Jew in the sense we use the word didn't exist at the time. They were not enemies of God here. I mean, some of them may have been. Even Esther herself says, it's the sins of my own people who may have caused some of this. That might be true, because they didn't go back with Zerubbabel to Jerusalem. That's certainly true. Being in the harem, probably she had no choice, but that doesn't refer to the entire people. The concept of Babylon, whether it be ruled by Alexander or by Xerxes or anyone else, was attempting to create a racial mixture. Alexander, the great conqueror. I mentioned the wedding, the Susa weddings in the beginning. Trying to mix the two traditions. The Zoroaster on the one hand, and the Greek writers, Hesiod on down, on the other. Of course, everything has changed once Christ was killed by the Jews, and it was not just a matter of being killed by the Jews. That they screamed for his death, even though Pilate didn't want it, but that they continued to justify it. They continue the war against him. They crucify him again and again and again and again. Which is, we don't say stupid things like Christ killer. That's only idiots say that. We don't say anything that's stupid. But they have partaken in his murder in a million different ways. And not just, the Soviet Union, the Eastern Europe, and every other place. Jews were at the forefront of the burning of churches. They are eternally Haman. Even Haman's 10 sons were all hanged. And he gives a lesson to more people too. We do not preach violence here. But this was pure self-defense. And of course, in Esther's case, there was no plundering done. Of course, it was easy for her to say. There's no reason to believe that this is not a historically accurate book. There's no reason to believe that it's a morally abject book, quite the contrary. There's no reason to say that God is not mentioned in it. It is. But it's extremely important. And although it was a minor part of the ancient church's tradition, even in the canons, it was still there and not really a part of the liturgical tradition. Of course, neither is the Song of Songs. The word God is mentioned in the Song of Songs, or I assume that by God they mean Yahweh, or some variant of it. But the Jews have twisted this for their own purposes. And it simply doesn't make any sense for those who know. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.